Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor. Voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, voices and stories from the 23rd session of the Assembly of State Parties to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, just concluded in The Hague. Issuance of arrest warrants against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former War Minister Yoav Gallant on November 21st descended like a lightning bolt on the two men, neither of whom reckoned they'd ever face justice for crimes they vehemently deny. Equally shaken up, some ready and willing to fulfill their duty to the world's top criminal court, others hedging their bets, were the 125 state parties, the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, soon to be tasked with executing those arrest warrants against Israeli leaders once they've been certified and communicated to them by the court registry. This past week, at the World Forum Convention Center in The Hague, representatives of those state parties gathered for the 23rd session of the ICC's Assembly of State Parties, the representative body that governs and supervises the implementation of the ICC's founding treaty, the Rome Statute, ultimately ensuring that the perpetrators of the most serious international crimes are arrested, tried, and jailed. Among the crimes Netanyahu and Gallant have been charged with in warrants classified secret, the war crime of starvation as a method of warfare, and the crimes against humanity of murder, persecution, and other inhumane acts, all part of a widespread and systematic attack against the civilian population of Gaza, suggesting the crime of genocide, without actually using the term. The ICC pretrial chamber judges cited, quote, reasonable grounds to believe Netanyahu and Gallant intentionally and knowingly deprived the civilian population in Gaza of objects indispensable to their survival, unquote. On the sidelines of last week's Assembly of State Parties, dozens of side sessions featuring presentations by international legal scholars, human rights advocates, and ordinary people with stories to tell. One of those sessions focused on the destruction of Gaza's healthcare facilities, relentlessly pounded by U.S. bombs and missiles dropped by Israeli jet fighters. One of the panelists in that session, a physician named Junaid Sultan. Sultan is a cardiovascular surgeon based in Hull in the UK. Here's what he had to say about his time in Gaza, doing his utmost to save the lives of Gazans brutally injured in Israel's genocidal assault.
Thank you so much for having me here and for all of you to coming here and to witness to this testimony and what I witnessed. I will particularly take a bit more time on this question and just go in a bit more detail. And as I walked into Gaza and what I saw, and I kind of, you know, as the whole of this mission progressed. In one line, I could say that I witnessed an Armageddon. At times, I felt like that I've been pushed back into the medieval times. Because what I was witnessing was I have never seen in any other part of the world anywhere. I walked into the Gaza and I was surprised that there was a constant drone hovering on top of a medical mission, non-stop 24/7 sound, which will not make you to basically to sleep, constant bombs and firearms going around you, and very often you will feel kind of, you know, that you are all the time, basically there is a sense of danger that anything can go wrong because bombs falling right and left of you, kind of, you know, and even being in a hospital where you feel that you are in a safe environment, these things will just never stop. And a constant sense of being watched and surveillance. And even as a humanitarian, if you go into any other part of the conflict zone or any other part of the world, you will not experience this sort of a feeling in any other conflict zone. And as you walk on the road, kind of, you know, like my journey when I was walking towards the hospital, and basically what I witnessed all around was that there were houses and houses which were just destroyed. There were streets which was basically completely destroyed, not a single house which you could say that it is in good state. There were towns literally just wiped out. And you see this sort of a level of destruction and you question yourself, why? And it was naturally put you in a sense of psychologically very fearful kind of, you know, state that what I'm going through, what I'm passing through, and what is this kind of, you know, happening here. There was no running water. There was no electricity. There will be curfew after 5 o'clock and you'll be asked not to go out wherever you are. So you'll be very closely monitored, and if you are supposed to go from point A to point B, and unless you ask for a permission, and without the permission you will not be allowed to move basically, and if you do, there is no guarantee you could be bombed. So it is such close kind of a surveillance and monitoring. So every action you do, it is constantly watched and monitored. When I entered the hospital, and it was like devastating to see, there were about 30,000 refugees in the hospital. The whole of the hospital protocol was completely lost. There were refugees in the corridors, on the wards, in the labs, everywhere. The result and impact of that was huge, because the whole hospital sterility, the hospital protocol, they were completely thrown out of the door. You cannot maintain the normal hospital practice in that kind of a situation. Because that many number of refugees, it has an impact on everything. I can tell you, like, there were even flies in the operating room purely because of these sort of things. Because you cannot measure and you cannot adopt the normal standard protocol to run a proper service, basically. Because the hospitals were small and they were not able to cope with that many number of individuals on the hospital premises. There was no sanitation. There were no toilets. At times, people were waiting for up to 3 to 4 hours to use the toilet. This was the sort of a situation which was going on. We passed by and we saw there were no greenhouses, or the greenhouses which were there, they were completely destroyed. I would like to mention about then what I particularly witnessed. This was the outside life, but what about the healthcare kind of, you know, premises? So particularly for the healthcare, I would like to highlight 3 important points to you guys. So first of all, the healthcare infrastructure was just completely destroyed and decimated. So when I was there in April, the 2 big hospitals of the Gaza, the Shifa and Al Nasser, they were completely out of order, they were destroyed, and they were being stopped from working completely. So the most of the workload which fell, which was on the European General and Al Aqsa Hospital. And these are not actually big hospitals. They are like a district level hospital which can maintain some sort of a workload, but they did not have a capacity to deal with 2.2 million kind of, you know, population basically. Like the European hospital had hardly 4 operating theaters. Like for a population of this much size and a constant bombing and the warfare injuries which were coming, you needed at least like 20 theaters running all the time. This is the sort of a capacity you needed. And we were being asked to work in this hospital with only 4 theaters because there was no other alternative. Al Aqsa Hospital, before 7th of October, actually they were in the process of renovating their theaters. So the operating theater at Al Aqsa Hospital was actually closed for the natural reasons for renovation. And because after 7th of October, they could not immediately renovate or do anything because supplies were stopped. So they converted the labor room into the operating theater. And that was not an adequate kind of an operating theater to deal with these sort of injuries and to cope with that. And that was only 2 theaters which were semi kind of, you know, modified to deal with some of these kind of, you know, injuries. So what I'm talking is that the healthcare structure which was there or which was available, that was not kind of, you know, for the purpose to deal with what we were asked to kind of, you know, provide the services. Then the second fact was the lack of the specialist services plus the lack of the specialist equipment. For example, I'll quote you some examples for that. Like cancer patients. So Gaza was built in a way that there were some specialist services which were being designed and built. Like there was a cancer specialist hospital called Turkish Hospital. There was a pediatric specialist hospital. There was a maternity specialist hospital. And all of these were being stopped and completely out of the service. So the cancer patients were essentially not getting any treatment at all. The pediatric patients, they had to go to other hospital to get kind of, you know, whatever treatment they can. But their specialist center was being stopped as well. For cancer patients, it was so worse that they were not able to get any sort of a medication at all, the specialist medication which cancer patient gets. So it was pretty much a death sentence for them. When I was at European hospital during April, Al-Nasser Hospital was one of the main hospitals to provide basically services to the renal patients and to give them dialysis. And that went out of the order. So the renal patients in particularly had a extreme suffering. And if the dialysis or the renal patients do not get dialysis, it's pretty much a death sentence to them. And the death, which is actually a very horrible death, because when they will not receive their dialysis, they will take kind of, you know, a few weeks to die because of, you know, their urea levels going high, making them confused, a very painful process. And no painkillers to keep them comfortable. And when they are getting confused, painful, in front of their family members and dying in such a... So there was no palliative measures either as well. So the whole process was very, very painful, and to witness that happen. There is no MRI machine right now in the whole of the MRI. And a lot of the patients need MRI. So that specialist service is not. There are only two CT scans which are semi-broken. And the spare parts have been requested for the last 6 months, and they have not been allowed by the COGAT to go in there. So this is like, I can count on those specialist services, and kind of, you know, it is just keeps on going, the list keeps on growing. Then the third thing which I would mention, because it has not been mentioned, and I feel like it's very important to know, and that is access to the healthcare facilities. Because it is very important that you need to understand that in Gaza, you know, in the past when everything was fine before 7th of October, to get to point A to point B, it's a small place. It will hardly take maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes. But right now that journey has gone to about 3 to 4 hours at times. And the factors are basically excessive number of checkpoints, curfew, damaged roads, no transport, or if somebody has a car, there is no fuel. And when you have kind of, you know, an injured patient and you have to transfer that patient, and how you transfer and take them to the hospital, it becomes a nightmare. And the roads particularly to the hospital, they have been particularly targeted, and anybody coming onto those roads, they get bombed. So access to the hospital is a very fundamental right of any civilian, and that has been pretty much denied to this. I can give you an example. I saw a child, an 8-year-old, which came to see me because they were in north and he was fired a bullet in his groin. It was a miracle that this child survived. And they kept hiding in the north. Finally, they managed to evacuate to the south. And they came to see me and they begged me that if they can do something to sort that out, because this child was not able to walk, was not able to put his foot on the ground because of persistent pain. Because this was a sort of a burst bullet which burst in his groin, and it was putting pressure on his nerve and small blood vessel. And on that day, there was a heavy day with a heavy casualty, and none of the operating theaters was available. And I had no choice, because this father said to me that I've got only 2 hours. If you can do something, do it, because I will not be able to get access to come back to the hospital after that. So I was forced kind of, you know, to operate on this child under local anesthesia to remove this bullet from his groin in theater recovery, because that was the only opportunity, because otherwise this would not happen. And because the complaint was because this father and the child, they do not have access to the healthcare facilities, and they cannot come. And if they come, pretty much they are at high risk of getting killed. So these are the sort of the things which kind of, you know, which you come across and which you see how the healthcare system was completely decimated. You asked me about the injuries, and I will go into that in a bit more detail. So the number of injuries I witnessed was I will put it into three different categories. The first category of the patients which I saw the most was the direct warfare injuries, basically, which were either the bomb blasts or firearm or the burn injuries. The bomb related patients were they were pretty much almost dead, because the shrapnels in the bombs, and they were causing so much extensive damage. When they were arriving on scene, a lot of the bodies were decapitated, unrecognizable, extensive damage. Or even when the small shrapnels, which is about the size of like literally 2 to 3 millimeter, you'll be surprised at the amount of damage they will cause. They will go into the tummy and they will completely destroy the abdomen, the small bowel and large bowel of the patient. So when you open the bowel, it is basically not sustainable with life. So you pretty much just declare them dead. So these are the sort of injuries which you will experience with these bombings. And then the firearm injuries were very, very damaging and very debilitating, because the snipers were attacking pretty much every blood vessel in the body. And as a vascular surgeon, I pretty much operated on every blood vessel I could think of while I was in Gaza. Because there were firearms hit on the carotid arteries, on the arms, on the legs. But their particular target was, the favorite one was actually around the knee to the superficial femoral artery, we call it. And the reason for that was that because when they fire there, either the patients bleed to death, but if they survive, it causes a very debilitative, extensive damage, because not only it damages the blood vessel and the nerve, but it also destroys the knee joint and the kneecap of the patient. And if they survive, this causes an extensive damage and the knee becomes unusable, and pretty much at some point they will end up with an amputation. And in Gaza, you ask any patient that you are going to have an amputation, it's like a and they are not psychologically, they accept this, because for them not able to work and everything, it puts them in a very difficult position. So that was a lot which we witnessed. And then on top, these wounds getting infected and not healing, and it was catastrophic. And the third category of the and the second category of the patient which we saw a lot was the patients who were already treated in different hospitals for the warfare injuries. But because of lack of antibiotics, painkiller, and other medical facilities, they pretty much all of them got complication. The complication rate in Gaza is 100%. And a physician, I'm saying this, make a very strong statement. And the complication rate of 100% means pretty much death sentence in a lot of situations. Because a wound which gets infected, not healing, you cannot fix it then. And one of the reasons for that was because when the Al-Shifa and Al-Nasr and other hospital got completely destroyed, the patients were forced to leave. And they had nowhere to go, they had no follow-up, they had no treatment, no medication, no supply of anything. And they all came with infected wounds, and then that was a second major load of patients which we have to treat on top of the acute warfare injuries. And the third set of patients were those who were actually from the day-to-day routine life. For example, you know, patients with the heart attacks, strokes, renal patients, diabetic patients. And because these patients were at the least priority and they were getting affected in the worst possible way. And I give you a very common example. Like, being a vascular surgeon, I see diabetic foot patients quite a lot. And diabetic foot infection happens in the foot. You give them a week of antibiotics, most of them get treated. Like 8 out of 10. 2 to 3 out of them, kind of, you know, they may need some small operation to drain and kind of, you know, treat them. But they get away, they still preserve their foot and they can manage to walk on it. However, in Gaza, that was not the situation. I had to do number of amputations on patients for just a minor foot infection. Because of lack of antibiotics, access to the hospitals to get in time, in reasonable time, they were not able to get it treated, and they ended up with necrotizing fasciitis, and I had to do below and above knee amputations on them. And it was devastating to do these sort of things on, like, young patients, because it was going to have a significant impact on their on life, because they were so young, but also on their families. Young family, supportive of few kids, and it is, you know, like, gonna affect the whole family basically. So I hope this gives you an idea of what it was and what I witnessed, and what it was basically going through for them on day-to-day basis.
Junaid Sultan is a cardiovascular surgeon based in Hull in the UK. He was speaking here at a side session of the 23rd session of the Assembly of State Parties to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. Read more about Israel's destruction of Gaza's healthcare system and the work of physicians like Dr. Junaid Sultan at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Assembly of State Parties to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court in The Hague featured brief presentations by State Party delegates. The only one to speak about Israel's war on Gaza in any detail was the Minister of Justice for the Southwest African nation of Namibia, Yvonne Dausib. Here she is.
I now will give floor to the second speaker, Her Excellency Ms. Yvonne Dausib, Minister of Justice of Namibia. You have the floor, Your Excellency.
Thank you very much,
Namibia congratulates you, Madam, on your election as President of the Assembly of State Parties of this 23rd session. We are also congratulating the Bureau on their appointment for the session and acknowledge with appreciation the incredible work done by the Bureau. Madam President, the ongoing armed conflicts across the world, including in the DRC, Sudan, Ethiopia, and the occupied Palestinian territory, threatens regional and world peace and our very existence. It seems the declaration of never again has become an empty promise to the global community as states continue to compromise our commitment to peace, security, and the protection of human rights, regardless of who the perpetrators and victims are. The future of humanity demands that we reaffirm the role of the International Criminal Court with its noble intent to be an instrument that brings justice for victims against whom the most serious crimes were committed without fear, prejudice, or favor. The court's independence, impartiality, and integrity is sacrosanct and should be protected. All courts, domestic, regional, or international, must enjoy this privilege and protection to undertake their function without an axe of sanctions and other coercive measures held over them. We must be consistent in how these key legal precepts are applied. The crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and the crime of aggression must be prosecuted in equal application against perpetrators and clarity of definitional elements to ensure the negative impact on humanity is minimized. Nations of the world must be firm and consistent about the consequences of non-compliance with the Rome Statute of the ICC. Otherwise, it makes it meaningless. It even begs the question, why we have this noble international instrument creating a court if we can't comply with its letter, spirit, and tenets, or even worse, yet that we apply it selectively. Conflict-induced humanitarian crisis impedes the enjoyment of human rights, including the right to development. It goes against the fundamentals of sovereign equality, universal peace, and distorts the noble aspirations of human connection. It causes devastating and often untold suffering and destruction. We must ask ourselves, how can we stand by and watch? Today, 76 years following the adoption of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights and the Genocide Convention, we must remember why then and today never again must regain and maintain its significance and true meaning. Namibia is appalled by the death, injury, and suffering of the people of the occupied Palestinian territory, their indiscriminate displacement, the destruction of infrastructure, including schools and hospitals, the denial of access to humanitarian aid is a total affront to the Geneva Conventions. Clearly, the face and nature of war has changed. War is nuanced in the aspects of climate change, cybercrime, blockades, global governance challenges, and the rise in conflict across the global spectrum of activity. One life lost is one too many. In Palestine, thousands of lives are lost on a daily basis. Our civilized collective conscience must be horrified. Namibia therefore welcomes the recent arrest warrants being issued by the International Criminal Court of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. That special treatment given to the crime of aggression under the current framework leaves smaller and more vulnerable states exposed to the threat of unmitigated aggression, often without any legal recourse. Genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity can be prosecuted under the International Criminal Court's jurisdiction without restraints, but the crime of aggression is inhibited by serious procedural and jurisdictional bottlenecks, which leaves many victims without recourse. A harmonized regime would better protect African nations from external violations of sovereignty, while also strengthening the broader international legal order. In alignment with Ghana's position on the principle of complementarity of jurisdiction, our late president, Dr. Hage G. Kenkop, may his soul continue to rest in peace, called on African states to develop its own processes, systems, courts, and institutions to be self-sufficient and build lasting institutions that will respond to the crisis in the world. Madam President, esteemed delegates, Namibia supports a consideration to A, remove the jurisdictional limitations on the crime of aggression, B, abolish the proposal that state parties to opt out of the court's jurisdiction over the crime of aggression, and finally, expand the definition of aggression to cover a wider range of acts and not limit it to primarily military action. The face of war has changed, and the world must be responsive. Namibia concludes and reminds us to have this dialogue in a spirit of mutual trust, equality of states, and the collective good of all our peoples. And that Africa in particular, given its own historical experience with aggression during the colonial period, asserts its role to find best ways to prevent, fight, and resolve future conflicts as an equal with 54 member-strong sovereign states that are poised to play their role without fear or prejudice. In the midst of adversity, we must choose unity. In the midst of growing geopolitical tensions and uncertainty, our resolve as Africans should be to unite against the common enemy of impunity and aggression. It has no place in societies that pursue peace, justice, and humanity. We must always choose peace. I thank you.
Yvonne Dausab is the Minister of Justice from the Southwest African nation of Namibia. Here's more of Dr. Junaid Sultan's presentation at last week's Assembly of State Parties to the Rome Statute of the ICC in The Hague, being questioned by panel chair Mira Nasir, legal officer with the International Center of Justice for Palestinians.
Dr. Sultan, I want to bring you in on what we've been discussing about the starvation of civilians. Can you please tell us just about what you saw in patients at the European hospital when you were there, as well as the level of aid and supplies that were available to you in Gaza? You touched on this a little bit at the beginning. And what impact any starvation or malnourishment in patients had on their long-term care?
So, when we were entering inside Gaza, so we saw like there were trucks standing outside there. So we were one of the last missions actually who entered Gaza via Rafah, and we came out via Rafah. We were the last one. And while going inside Gaza, we saw like there were about easily probably 3,000 plus trucks, which were like they were like queues of up to kind of, you know, like kilometers, kind of, you know, miles, kind of, you know, which were standing. And there was aid and supplies standing there, but they were just not allowed to go in. And at times, kind of, you know, even as part of the NGOs, when we were trying to get supplies and stuff in, the whole of the container would be rejected based on very small thing, like it has one needle in it, and this needle is not allowed, and the whole truck will be literally rejected. So this was the level of, kind of, you know, which we were dealing with, and that had an impact on the supplies to go in. So when we went in, I basically firsthand, in one single statement, I can confirm you, I saw and I witnessed evidence of malnutrition, starvation, and man-made famine among patients, their relatives, and the staff members. And it was devastating to see this. So I start with, kind of, you know, let's say, kind of, you know, the doctors and nurses who were working with me. And, you know, you could see them, you know, they were just literally bones. And when you ask them to, you know, show their pictures on their phones, you know, which was before 7th of October, and you could clearly see they had lost easily about 20 plus kind of, you know, kg weight. And they were starving. They were all in loose clothes, you know, their clothes which they used to wear, they were kind of, you know, so loose and things like that. Then when it was coming to the patients, and it was very kind of, you know, painful sometimes to hear, some of the patients mentioned to me that I had one meal in whole week, and sometimes even more. So someone with kind of, you know, so many wounds, kind of, you know, which kind of, you know, and massive surgery. I'll give you an example of a 28-year-old who had been a victim of a blast wound, and he had bilateral hip fractures. And when he came to the hospital, he was actually treated at Al-Nasser Hospital, and then he was supposed to be evacuated from there because Al-Nasser Hospital was stopped and destroyed and stopped working. So when he came to the European General Hospital, he had not had any kind of a bath, kind of, you know, like probably for months. The blanket he was covering on top, kind of, you know, that wasn't washed for months. It had fleas in it, and he hasn't had a food. He's saying that, kind of, you know, he probably had a last meal about more than 10 days ago, and he probably gets something, kind of, you know, at a frequency of maybe once a week or 10 days, kind of like that. His parents, who were elderly, and they said that they don't eat anything, whatever they get, they try to feed him. Because if they will eat themselves, what will they feed to him? And this was a sort of a situation patients and their families were living. And when I kind of, you know, uncovered the blanket, kind of, you know, which was covered with fleas, I saw maggots in the wounds of that patient. And I'm giving this example, it all links everything together, what the lack of nutrition can do to somebody. You know, completely decrease immunity, increase infection, and it increases the rate of complications sky high. And this patient, because of lack of then painkillers and other things,